Right. So opening the November Interpretations Committee meeting and starting off with lease term, and I'm handing over to Catherine.
Thank you, Sue. Good morning, everybody. So we're starting with agenda paper four today, which analyses comments on the committee's tentative agenda decision published in June 2019 about how to determine the lease term of cancellable and renewable leases and the useful life of any related non-removable leasehold improvement. The committee received 31 comment letters on this topic, and all of those are available on the IFRS Foundation website. In light of those comments, there are several parts to our paper. I'm going to tee them all up together before handing over for discussion. So the first question addressed in the agenda decision was about how to determine the enforceable period and lease term of cancellable and renewable leases. By way of context, and as described in paragraphs 2 and 3 of the paper, the enforceable period effectively sets a maximum possible lease term. Practically speaking, it defines the period during which a lessee is required to assess whether it is reasonably certain to use any optional periods that are available to it. Only those optional periods that a lessee is reasonably certain to use will find their way into the IFRS 16 lease term. In other words, enforceable period and lease term are not the same thing. Now, what the agenda decision does is describe the application of paragraph B34 of IFRS 16, which explains that the enforceable period of a lease ends when the lessee and lessor each have the right to terminate the lease without permission from the other party with no more than an insignificant penalty. In respect of that first question, 9 respondents agreed with the committee's conclusions, and that was for the reasons that were set out in the tentative agenda decision. The remaining 22 disagreed with one or more aspects of the committee's technical analysis and conclusions, with 17 of them recommending standard setting as an alternative to publishing an agenda decision. The second topic was about the useful life of any related non-removable leasehold improvements. Again, 9 respondents agreed with the committee's technical analysis and conclusions. Most of the other respondents did not explicitly comment on this part of the agenda decision, and of those that did, only 3 respondents explicitly disagreed with the committee's conclusions. Now, as described in the paper, we think that across both questions, the comment letters have not identified any new information that would change the technical analysis that was discussed by the committee in June. For that reason, we continue to conclude that an entity can determine its accounting for the fact pattern described in the submission using the requirements in IFRS 16 and in IAS 16. So our first question for the committee today is whether you agree with that technical analysis. Notwithstanding that conclusion, however, we do acknowledge that determining that accounting needs analysis of the requirements of the standard within their context. Now, that reading is entirely consistent with how principles-based standards should always be read. It is, however, possible that clarification could help make those requirements of the standard more easily accessible. Consequently, we think that if the committee agrees with our technical analysis, it could consider one of 2 courses of action. So our second question for the committee today is whether you agree to finalise the agenda decision as set out in Appendix A of the paper, or whether you recommend a clarifying amendment to paragraph B34 of IFRS 16 as part of the next annual improvement to IFRS standards. So with that, I will hand over to the committee for discussion of first question 1 and then question 2.
Okay, and I suggest actually we break question 1 2 parts, so we discuss first of all the technical analysis in relation to the first part of the paper up to paragraph 51 on the lease term as the first part of the discussion.
needs to begin. There is a thing which I think is fundamental, with which I disagree with the staff, is what is expressed in paragraph 36 of the agenda paper, which is enforceable is not a defined term in IFRS 16, maybe, for sure, nor any other IFRS standard. And I disagree with this bit of the sentence. I think enforceable is defined in IFRS 15. Of course, it's not in Appendix A definitions of IFRS 15, but paragraph 10 of IFRS 15 is pretty clear in this instance. It states a contract is an agreement between two or more parties that creates enforceable rights and obligations. Enforceability of the rights and obligations in a contract is a matter of law. And then contract can be written oral or implied by an entity's customary business practices. So I think this sentence, enforceability of the rights and obligations in a contract is a matter of law, is a definition of what enforceability means. And applied to IFRS 15, there is an implied presumption deriving from this that the duration of a contract is the nominal duration of the contract, except in exceptional circumstances whereby you would add to the nominal duration of a contract an option if this option brings a material right to the customer. So there is enforceability defined in IFRS 15, which has a very strict implication in the way you read then IFRS 15, which is rather, or which brings a rather legal implication as to how you account for revenue within IFRS 15. So I think the problem there with IFRS 16 is that enforceable rights and obligations is a term that that has been used also in IFRS 16. And I think it has led to difficulties in interpretation for some, in the sense that effectively they didn't know exactly necessarily what should be the duration of the lease contract, and they maybe and surely wrongly by analogy analyzed things the same way they would have done in IFRS 15. So and the problem is that in IFRS 15 I think the presumption is reversed. It means that you have a kind of presumption that the nominal duration of the contract is not the lease term of the contract to retain in assessing the lease liability and the right of use assets. You need to take into consideration some options to renew the contract, and so the question, the mere question is how many options should I retain in assessing the lease term of the contract? And I think what is key there is really that these words, enforceable rights and obligations that have been used in IFRS 16, I think they should have been written a bit differently so as not been misinterpreted by some as something rather equivalent to IFRS 15. So in what we analyzed in the submission is a contract with no contractual duration. So let's assume a one-year contract with a tacit renewal option or tacit renewal, yearly tacit renewal options. So there, effectively, some said, okay, I don't know exactly what to retain, so I will retain the same as I would do in IFRS 15 because it's the same word, enforceable rights and obligations, and I will retain a year. Obviously, it doesn't fit. This answer does not fit with the IFRS 16 model, for sure. It is not the proper answer. But at the same time, I perfectly understand that some may have misinterpreted the words enforceable rights and obligations applied to IFRS 16, referring by analogy to IFRS 15. So I really disagree with the statements that enforceability is not defined in another standard. It is defined very clearly in IFRS 15. It has a very clear meaning in IFRS 15, and it has very strict consequences in IFRS 15. And sadly, because the words in IFRS 16 that are written are the same, they were interpreted the same by some, and I think they were wrongly interpreted the same by some. But at the same time, you cannot blame them for the fact that the same words are used in the two standards and implying two different meanings.
Bertrand, does that mean that those people who have so carefully read IFRS 15 didn't read B34?
No, I think...
Because clearly there's a very specific description of what enforceable means.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, Sue. At the same time, as I always mention, what is very clear for a native English speaker might not be very clear for a non-native English speaker, honestly. And when you, at a certain point of time, you have, when you do a transition project to a new standard, you have very little time to decide on options. And so, on options to apply. And for the transition to IFRS 16, there were very, very huge practical problems. The fact that IT systems were not, or IT applications were not satisfactorily performing. So there were other practical problems, and probably some people did not exactly took enough time to carefully consider what enforceable rights and obligations was clearly meaning in the context of IFRS 16. I must say, I share the staff analysis. I've already said that. It's exactly what we applied at Vivendi when as the case may be, we are not significantly impacted. I mean, we don't have such contracts with no contractual duration. We don't have significant impacts or numbers of contracts with such aspects. But I must admit, I totally agree with the conclusion raised by the staff. My only point is just to say I can understand why some answered not correctly to the question of the lease term in such instances. And I think it's because they effectively probably misinterpreted similar words used in IFRS 15 as in IFRS 15 and decided that those words should have the same meaning, which can't be in the context of IFRS 16 for sure.
Yeah. And I think my, at the risk of sounding completely lacking in empathy, I think my only concern, I guess, or is that, you know, if I had my time again, I would love to have another word in B34. I would love to have the word economic in there. Mm. But even if I'd had the perfect words in B34, even if I'd had in there with no more than an insignificant economic penalty, if somebody can say, well, I read IFRS 15 and I thought I knew what enforceable meant and I didn't have time to read B34, I'd be in exactly the same position.
No, I think the problem is probably... but then we are deriving on the second question. You didn't want us to answer the second question after having finalised the first. What I'm just saying is that I think the problem is not economic penalty. The problem is enforceable.
Bertrand, don't you get to the same place, though? I mean, the contract either provides or it does not provide enforceable rights at law, the extension periods. You know, that's sort of what we're talking about here. If the lessee has got that right and the lessor has got the obligation, this is all a matter of contract law, presumably, is what's the problem?
The problem is, once again, for the types of contracts we talked about in deriving from the question asked in the submission, those are contracts whereby, the contract does not contain any specific legal requirements as to the contract duration. So you need to assess the contract duration without having the contract or the law providing you with a proper answer so as to what is exactly the lease term or what should be the lease term. So then effectively, for that, you need to assess something else. And notably then, you need to assess the rather economic or more economic approach, and notably to assess what would be your economic penalty, so the penalty you would suffer from if you had to abandon the contract for whatever reason. So the problem there is effectively that the contract or the law, so the legal requirements, do not provide you with an immediate answer. So you need to assess something else. And the problem is this one is people, some at least, did not quite well get how to determine that. I mean, it might be very clear written in the standard, it might, but don't forget that it's a new standard. And we have, for instance, I was surprised when we received to elaborate things differently. I was quite surprised as an interpretations committee member that we received questions on IFRS 15 that related directly to the core principle of IFRS 15, transfer of control. And you could understand from the question received that people had not understood the transfer of control principle. They were still reasoning transfer of risk and rewards. So it's amazing. It's written perfectly, transfer of control. IFRS 15 is very clear. Enforceable rights and obligations are defined. I mean, everything is pretty clear in the standard, but still they read transfer of risk and rewards and not transfer of control. So it's not because something is clearly written in a standard that mechanically people will apply it correctly. So I can understand in some instances why people did not interpret IFRS 16 correctly with the words enforceable rights and obligations used in IFRS 15, and they read it the same as in IFRS 15, which is incorrect. I agree with the staff on that. And as a preparer, I absolutely did not understand IFRS 16 that way, but I can understand why some did understood things differently.
But I think there was no question of read 16 and all the backup to it. Is the intention was you consider renewal and extension periods. I mean, if they're in the contract, you're not obligated to do them, but presumably the lessee has got an enforceable right to exercise renewal and extension periods. So if you have a one-year fixed non-term and 9 one-year renewals, assuming you behave properly and don't breach other parts of the contract, the lessee has the right for up to stay in that property for 10 years. Mm. And that would be a legal right. Now, I think then you default to, well, what is the economic drivers to do or not to do? But assuming the lessor cannot stop that, I think we're in the same place. The enforceable right is the contract, but the contract includes the renewal periods.
Yeah, but then the mere question there then in IFRS 16 is, as I said previously, how many periods will you retain? Okay. How many renewal options will you retain to assess the lease term?
That's the B37 debate about what is the economic driver. There's a difference between the term, the maximum term, and the economic measures for what's the effective term.
And this second question is not that easy to answer in some instances.
But it's never been easy to answer.
What I'm just saying is that the words used, enforceable rights and obligation, brought some confusion for some in the application of the number of renewal options to retain to assess a lease term. And some even considered that when they had a one-year contract with just tacit renewal options, they were disregarding the tacit renewal options, which I think does not fit with IFRS 16, but it's the way they interpreted it. And the main reason is because the words used are enforceable rights and obligations, and they just replicated an IFRS 15 analysis to those.
I like the answer. Okay, now I've got two other board members with cards up. Do you want to come in before I let other committee members in? Or are you, Mary, are you doing something personal to this?
I think I would. I don't know if I should. Okay. Well, the first thing I'm going to say is it's brave of the committee to start with probably the most difficult issue on the agenda first thing.
And it's brave because we always start with finalising things.
Right. and it's particularly...
Sorry, I've checked.
Brave of Bertrand to lead out, especially when, as he explains, it's not a view he took personally, but he's thought about how people would in good faith read the words. Now, one of the things I want to go back to, and Bertrand, you may want to go back and edit the video before we do it, because there were a couple of times when you were talking about people misunderstanding or misreading, which sounds like, B34, which sounds like correction of an error rather than, a valid interpretive.
No,
that's why I said you want to edit it. But because I think the... one of the things that I found very, very helpful in this paper is that Catherine started us out in paragraph 3 with a diagram that distinguishes the determination of the lease term from determination of what is the enforceable contract. And I take your point about the potential crossover for IFRS 15 and IFRS 16 in terms of discussion of enforceability, but I think one of the things that we have to look at in thinking about this issue is the words of B34, which are part of the authoritative text of the standard, that says a lease is no longer enforceable. You know, it doesn't say when the contract ends. It says when the lessee and lessor each have the right to terminate the lease without permission from the other party with no more than an insignificant penalty. Now, I think part of the application question that you're dealing with here is the insignificant penalty part, but we're not talking about that yet. We're not talking about the what do you consider in determining what the penalty is. We're back, if you look at paragraph 3, about just saying what is the enforceable period. And, you know, at first when we went into this, I was scratching my head a bit personally in terms of remind me why we were saying both parties have to have it. And it's really just the basics of saying you may have a, you know, in our contract, you may have a right that I don't have, but your right is still enforceable even if I don't have a countervailing right, and vice versa. That's why both parties have to have the ability to cancel and deter, you know, in coming to the end of the enforceable period. So if I look at B34, even knowing what's in and having been reminded about IFRS 15, I think we do have, in terms of determining what is the enforceable period, you know, a discussion that's directly on point that says, in the standard that you were applying, you know, before you get to it, that says the enforceable period ends when, you know, neither party, you know, when neither party, I'm using my own words here, has a right. And so I think we're, you know, the first question we're asking is, what do you consider in determining whether either party still has a right? So before we jump to, I just have a rolling 12-month, I think the standard tells you you have to consider whether either party has a right there. That, you know, that's, and I think that's all the that's all that the first very part of this question concept is asking. Hmm. So that's all I wanted to do in terms of bringing back to the words of B34 before we start reaching out to IFRS 15 or, you know, or something else to say what context might you have read that word enforceable in.
Yeah, but as I mentioned, reading B34, I totally agree with what you were saying, Maria, by the way. But the point is then, the second question is, so then when I'm in a context of a one-year contract, mm-hmm. With tacit renewal options, mm-hmm. how many options do we have to take into consideration to assess the lease term?
Right.
That is the key question.
Right. That's the build-on, but I want to make sure that we have the right foundation before we get before we kind of start going down a rabbit hole of what is all the uses of enforceable and IFRS standards. Yeah. I think we have to work from B34.
Did I have to read the standard I'm applying?
Yeah, to echo what you're saying, it's exactly what you're saying, mm-hmm. is exactly the way I mm-hmm. read B34 and the way we applied it, mm-hmm. if necessary, mm-hmm. At Vivendi. I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. Okay. What I can understand mm-hmm. is people saying, because there is the word enforceable mm-hmm. there used, and because the standard is new, and mm-hmm. because each time a standard is new, even though everything is perfectly clearly written in it, you may have people having difficulties struggling with the new concept contained in the new standard. There it was the case, and they just, because enforceable was written there, they mm-hmm. just referred to what they already knew as what would be an application of enforceable rights and obligations, and so they referred to IFRS 15. Therefore, they just concluded that they had a one-year contract, which is totally crazy in the context of IFRS 16.
But you do agree that
some did effectively conclude that.
Right, but Bertrand, you do agree that we shouldn't really be accepting the fact that because somebody thought they knew what enforceable meant, they decided not to read paragraphs of the standard they were applying.
We're at risk of saying that. I think it's even tougher because if B34 had only the first sentence, which is, shall apply the definition of a contract and determine the period for which the contract is enforceable. If the paragraph ended there, I think I might be more sympathetic to your point. But the problem is that they'd have to go, instead of reading on to the second sentence in the paragraph, they'd have to say, wait, I'm going to not finish this paragraph and I'm going to go to IFRS 15. Yeah. Because the second sentence in the same paragraph says, let me tell you when a lease is no longer enforceable. And the presence of that sentence right there is where I take the point about 15's thinking, coloring, being coloring. But to go, just because the first sentence has enforceable, to say, I'm going to stop and apply the discussion in 15 without considering something more, means not reading the second sentence of the same paragraph. So that's what I think is the problem in terms of what does enforceable mean. I'm not saying that this has X meaning in terms of what you consider in terms of penalty. I'm just trying to get to the enforceable part.
Yeah. All right, so...
I realise I'm speaking out of turn, but I do just have a specific observation on this very point, and it's about IFRS 15, and I do not think that enforceable is a wholly unproblematic concept in IFRS 15, and it was in fact taken to the Revenue TRG. We had a paper on what enforceable meant, and it was paper 48, for those of you who can't remember.
You won the award for geek of the day.
Before 10 a.m.
It's relevant here. It's relevant here because we discussed the case where I buy something like an aircraft engine, and does that mean I'm economically compelled to buy the spares? Probably not. But then there was a second case that was all about contract term. If a customer could cancel but would suffer a penalty. And I do think that the outcome of that discussion, so IFRS 15, all about enforceable rights and obligations, but the outcome of that discussion was that the existence of a substantive termination penalty might give evidence as to what were the enforceable rights and obligations. And I think that is now an accepted view in the revenue recognition world. I think it's written up into the AICPA guidance for some kind of specific kind of industries. So when I come to B34, I do kind of remember the sequence of events, and I do kind of come at it through paragraph 10 of IFRS 15, but I come at it in the light of that discussion, where I do think, even in a revenue recognition context where you don't have the other supporting things in IFRS 16, that I would think about a substantive termination penalty as providing evidence as to what are the enforceable rights and obligations. So when I come to IFRS 16, I'm in a different model, I'm thinking about options in a different way, but I'm already warmed up to the idea that a penalty is telling me something about enforceability. So I realise I'm speaking out of order, but that just seemed a relevant point.
OK, thank you, Brian. Daryl, you were also twitching, and then I'll go back to the normal order.
I waived my turn earlier, but I think the further conversation made me feel stronger about where I was coming from. I think, Bertrand, I understand where you're coming from, but I think there's a specific side topic almost that we really need to be considering here. Implementation of a new standard is hard. And I think there's a natural inclination for anybody implementing a new standard to look back to what you know, either the old standard or stuff that has gone before. And I think that's valid, and we still have problems as the ISB with things like depreciable term because of the fact that people got into a previous habit of doing that. But I think what the counterweight against that is that you have to read the whole new standard that you've got. And I'm really nervous of anything that we say which would countenance saying, well, it's okay to fall back on your old habits, when this circumstance is excusable because that's the way you've just done it on a previously implemented standard. And I think as much as we can discuss whether the terms in IFRS 16 in the context of IFRS 16 would lead you to a different conclusion, I think it's really hard when we start pointing to another standard that overrides what is in this particular standard. And I think a lot of what you were saying is that, yes, a logical person should have come to this conclusion, but, hey, I've got bad habits. I think we need to be careful about allowing for bad habits in implementation of a standard, because
we have to be quite disciplined.
Yep.
I mean, I think we can be empathetic that people might have got it wrong and they may need to change their policies, but that's different to saying, well, that was an appropriate reading of the words that we wrote. Young Su?
Yes. First of all, I want to say that I support the step analysis and conclusion. As for just the analysis, I think what's been asked was, what is penalty? And we say penalty is more than the penalty payment. It also includes some economic consequences with the penalty. So for that, I think we answered what we have been asked. So I support this type of analysis and conclusion. But I also want to echo Bertrand's the arguments about the legal side of the contract. I think enforceability must have both sides, economic side and legal side. And in this agenda decision, we just emphasize the economic side and too much about the economic side, I think, because we don't say anything about the legal side of the enforceability. And I think the enforceability also depends upon how the contract is written and what is a kind of legal system in which the contract has been written. And we don't say anything about that. That is why people are worrying about this agenda decision.
So both aspects, Bertrand.
Yeah, so you know, if we can put some words like the contract or the legal environment in the agenda decision, I can just accept that. It's very acceptable. But if we don't say anything about that, maybe you have to think seriously about standard setting.
Carsten.
I think the concept of enforceability in IFRS 16 clearly is different than that in IFRS 15. So I agree with that. I think if you read the word in context, that's pretty clear. I think the SES analysis is a reasonable reading of the standard, to summarize. The part I'm struggling with a little bit is in terms of whether it's absolutely clear what exactly it is that you take into account. So I agree it's a broader concept, clearly, in B34, that you would not just look at what is enforceable by law. I think that's clear from the words. But in terms of what exactly you take into consideration in addition to what's enforceable by law, I think that's the question here. I feel that, the staff analysis is focusing quite a bit on the term penalty and where it's, how it's used in other parts of IFRS 16, right? So where it talks about payments for penalties, whereas in paragraph B34 it just talks about penalties rather than payments of penalties. So it's very much focusing on that, and I understand that notion. I wouldn't disagree with that analysis. I just wonder, I'm not convinced it's entirely clear that there are not other parts of IFRS 16 that may be used to build an argument otherwise. I'm particularly thinking about, the wording in the same section of the lease term. So B37, for example, which talks about economic assessments and so on. And so I realize that, I understand that that's what the board's intention was. And I think it's a reasonable reading of the words in the standard. But I'm not entirely convinced that it's crystal clear that you would take into account the broader economics. I agree it's broader than just the law, so you would take into account payments of penalties clearly. But how broad is it? I think that's the key question. And so I think the direction of travel is clear, but I'm not entirely convinced that the words are sufficiently clear, and for that reason, I'm more leaning towards supporting something like an annual improvement or something like that.
Bob?
So when we discussed this the last time, I did vote for the agenda decision, and I did agree with the result. I still do agree with the result. It is from the way I read the standard. But when we receive a large amount of comment letters, and this is a large amount comparatively to other agenda decisions, and 70% of them are negative, forces me to sit back and say, do I have the right reading? Is this the only reading? I'm going to focus a little bit on a different issue. I'm going to come back to enforceability, but focus on the penalty issue. I took it as, when I read B34 and more than an insignificant penalty, that that should be viewed broadly, because I'm viewing it in the thinking about 16 and how 16 is, I thought 16 meant to have a broad concept on them. But I do understand the other view. What they point out is that when we talk about a broad view and looking at economic incentives, it's always referring to the assessment of reasonably certain. Now, reasonably certain is an assessment of the probability somebody will take an action. When we talk about B34, we're talking about whether somebody has a right to take an action, which is different. And so I think they have a different view that because I'm assessing whether I have the right, not the probability of somebody taking action, whether I do have the right, well, then the references to looking at economic incentives don't apply to that. And what do I do? Well, some look to IFRS 15, I think. Well, it's a standard that this standard was written right after that one. Why would I use the words differently? Now, that's, again, that's not my reading, but I understand that view. And because of that, you know, I think the more prudent action would be to do some standard saying, well, I don't know whether it is to write a sentence into B34 that indicates that the more than insignificant penalty should be viewed broadly, or whether we could do this as an interpretation. If we were to do the standard setting, you know, I think then enforceability, I don't think the standard is wrong, needs amendment, but I do admit the logic is a bit hard to understand. And I don't know whether we do it in the same place or outside education material, whatever, to try to explain that. And I think the difficulty becomes because B34 references BC 127, and I realize the basis for conclusions is not part of the standard, but we often, in agenda decisions, refer to basis for conclusions, say these are important. And the standard references this, and this is the sense I think that's really hard. It's if the lessee cannot enforce the extension of the lease without agreement of the lessor, the lessee does not have the right to use the asset beyond the non-cancelable period. So in B34, we neither have, both have the option, but neither have a penalty. We say, well, it's only the non-cancelable period because lessee, the lessor can cancel on you. Even if you didn't want to terminate, you wanted to continue on, lessor can cancel on you. Now, if I'm the lessee and I have a more than insignificant penalty, well, I've now jumped to enforceability, but why when the lessor can still cancel on me? Now, I realize why we do this and go to, you know, and say that the contract is enforceable, but I think that logic is difficult to understand and not well explained. But I don't know if that is part of an amendment or just more educational.
Lisa?
Okay, sorry. Yes, I would agree on the bit that when we think about enforceable, it's always deemed to be legally enforceable for both parties. In the second bit about the insignificant penalty, I think that how that kind of gets extended is that everyone thinks about a penalty as an actual payment. And if it's insignificant, then in substance, you don't have an enforceable right. I think in practice, it hasn't been deemed that, you know, you take into account all the potential economic benefits that someone might lose, because you still could have something that is actually still legally enforceable. So I would be more on the side that I think that this is something that needs to be clarified in the standard and possibly something part of an annual improvement.
Bruce?
Thanks, Sim. Look, to be fair, I think this is a very difficult issue, and maybe I'm clouded by the fact that I think there is a timing issue that's quite prevalent in terms of this. I always get concerned when we've got a new standard that we're mixing up the whole concept of allowing giving people a standard and allowing them to implement it and use their judgment versus us starting to drill down into every single word and feel we have to interpret every single word that's in the standard. And I guess, I mean, I agreed with in the original paper and with the staff, you know, I mean, I've always read penalty as a broader concept, but I will accept And having spoken to people, I do accept some people read that differently. And I guess the only thing I ask myself is, well, how much does it matter if people are reading things differently? When you open up these books, there are probably a million different places we can point to where people read things differently. And if you've applied a judgment into material, they need to disclose how they've applied that in the material to their judgment. So I'm saying my concern would be is if we start opening up interpretations of every little word and every little paragraph in a new sentence, my worry is that that the board are going to spend the next 10 years interpreting every little term that comes out of these standards. And I guess that's my concern. So I do agree with the broader reading, but I do have a lot of sympathy that people have read it different ways. I do accept that, yes, in an ideal world, if we could get the board to issue an amendment by the end of this year, it would be fantastic, and we can get great clarity out there. We know in a practical world that's not going to happen. And I guess there just is a point in my life where I say, if we're going for a judgment-based framework, a principle-based framework, give people the chance to apply their judgment. Let's get out there and do it. And I do accept that maybe people will apply these things differently, but we can point to 100 different places where people have applied 9 and 15 differently. We're giving them that freedom to do judgment. We're telling them to disclose where it is. And my view would be to do the same here.
Are you not concerned, though, Bruce, that the people that have read this narrowly are basically overriding all of the economic assessments on lease term?
Yeah, but Sue, if that's the way they are interpreting it, if that's the way they're looking at it and they believe that that's the right way they're going to do it, I get worried that we're becoming very rules-based and telling exactly what you need to do in every little level. And yeah, as I said, I think people have got different views of how they still understand this.
Okay, Guy?
I don't want to repeat what some have already verbalized, but I will say, similar to Bob's comment, I did agree with the tentative agenda decision and the analysis, and I think I again largely agree with how the staff have analyzed the comment letters that have come in, but. For reasons similar to what some others have said, I can very much appreciate the difficulty some stakeholders are having here in reading the words and coming to an answer that is obviously consistent with how I've been thinking about the standard, how staff have been thinking about the standard, how the broader committee has been thinking about the standard. And one of the things that comes to mind in the context of difficulty in piecing together the concepts in B34 that I think is relevant to this discussion is this definition of enforceability that we've introduced, in my mind, sort of begs a question as to, well, what is it that we're actually assessing here in terms of the enforceable period? And when I think about defining the enforceable period in the context of no more than an insignificant economic penalty for each of the parties, it then begs the question of, well, what does it even matter whether there's an agreement between the parties? If I just have an arrangement where one party is occupying some space, what am I assessing? Am I simply assessing, how long is that party going to stay in the context of that definition of enforceable period, even if there is no agreement whatsoever between the parties? I think the standard is saying assess the agreement in place between the parties in the context of this definition of enforceability. But that definition of enforceability seems to be disconnected with the concept of an agreement. That's another sort of aspect of this that I would put on the table that has perhaps caused people some confusion in terms of how to interpret what B34 is saying, and have therefore read it in a different way, because they're kind of thinking that to read it in the way that's intended, it sort of begs the question as to, what am I even assessing here? I don't even need an agreement in order to create. Having said all of that, it does strike me that with the the volume of comments that have come in that suggest that to a large number of stakeholders, this just isn't sufficiently clear. It does strike me that some form of standard setting is warranted here to bring more clarity to this.
Carl?
Hi, thanks. Different from others, I'm probably in the more comfortable side of the reading of the standard provided by staff in this paper. I think it's a compelling argument. I don't think there's a stretched logic in the paper. I think it's a very fluid logic. So it really does not brings me discomfort supporting this. And in terms of the approach to follow, I think it's too early to annoy improvements. And I'm really not sympathetic to accept that we should do a different approach because of the amount of comments in the recent past, in probably more in discussions a little more complex, and with probably more comment letters, we followed the agenda decision approach. I will follow the same approach in this issue.
Okay, thanks, Carl. Marie? Oh, did you give up?
Just to answer on the technical part, I think we fully agree with the technical analysis, but we also fully see that there was a lot of participants and coming from different jurisdictions and different background commenting, and obviously that read the standard differently. So for us, it means that they did not do it on purpose, but maybe something was not clear enough in the context where they apply for the first time IFRS 16. So it might be because of the reference to the BC, which is a bit different. It might be because the definition of penalty do have this notion of economic. It might be to the translation, maybe also, or to the notion of enforceable. But I think it's things that should be taken in mind that there are this question today. And I just wanted to also answer on this question saying it's only a judgment. So if people disclose, it's enough. I think for us, it's not enough because we are in something which is really important in the assessing the lease term, and it's sort of key part of what you have as an assets or liabilities when you apply IFRS 16. So in terms of consistency of application and comparability, it's really important that it's clarified for everybody.
Okay. Gary?
Thank you. Be listening to the discussion, I think we can probably, by reference to paragraph 3, you know, in the staff paper, it's going to go. I don't think it can really be debated that, you know, if you look, back up, go to paragraph 3, you know, the two middle option periods. I mean, we spent 5 years or more debating how to handle those things. It wasn't the left-hand column, minimum lease term. It was, what do you do about options renewals? And there can be no question that the board's intention was some of these things are going to be on the balance sheet on day one. I mean, I think that's irrefutable. I mean, there's nothing in the 7 years I've been here and the 10 years this has worked before then that says otherwise. In fact, I will appreciate people tell me, and they did at the June meeting, basic conclusion is not authoritative, but our preamble says you've got to consider the basis. And if you look at this first sentence of BC 156, in the ISB's view, the lease term should reflect an entity's reasonable expectation of the period during which the underlying asset will be used. I mean, that's these optional periods here. And you've got an enforceable contract at law really up to, you get to the right-hand box that says no contract. Now, you might debate, is it a smart thing to exercise the options, and what's a significant penalty today might be insignificant tomorrow, and vice versa, things change. The fact, presumably, is the lessee has that enforceable right throughout the first three boxes in the chart in paragraph 3. You throw that in with the entire debate was how much of those goes on the balance sheet. You throw in BC 156 as our expectation is whatever your reasonable expectation in there is what goes on the balance sheet. And then it just gets to be an estimation and judgment how much it and day one and presumably from reassessments along the way, what are your expectations for how much of those you reasonably expect to use? That's what this whole project was about. I think that's unchallengeable. Now, you might debate, is B34 clear language, awkward language? When you step back for the entire tenor of the entire project and the document, it's hard to walk away from and say it's something no longer than the non-cancelable period in the left-hand box. That's just an impossible read.
Jim.
I agree with the staff analysis, and I think this is what we should and could go as far as the current situation. Because, as Daryl just mentioned, implementing new standards is hard and even scary to some prudent accountants. Mm-hmm. Since we have to communicate these newly created principles by words, those words should be written by normal, educated accountants only. We just can't keep digging into these dictionaries, and you know, different dictionaries may give you different answers. What's the penalty to you? That's the question the preparers and their auditors, or even the authorities, local authorities, should answer together. It's not our job to redefine, I think Bruce mentioned, each and every word we use. And since we're still early in the practice, we give them the words, and some people are scared, so they guess what the words behind and what's the meaning of it. We just keep telling them the reasonable way of understanding. That's good enough. Once we lead the practice into the more mature environment, we should get comfortable feedbacks, and people know what should do to exercise accordingly. So I don't think we should read too much and give them further dictionary explanation of penalties, enforceability. And by the way, the diagram on page 17, I think, is also very helpful on the top of the page 3, paragraph 3 diagram. So if we can build this kind of logic into the answers, so we tell them, don't read into it too much. As a reasonable, educated accountant, you should do fine. And then maybe a couple of years down the road, when we accumulate enough practices, we can see what the really problems are. Maybe now all of these 20, 30 disagreements are, I think, guesses or worries, and we should lead them through this panic stage.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Bonnie?
Thanks, Sue. I was very happy that Bertrand started us off, because I think this is a difficult topic. I think when we spoke about this in June, I agreed with the staff conclusion. I still continue to agree with the staff conclusion, but I think just given the length of discussion, the number of comment letters, it also caused me to step back and think there's a lot of different ways that people are interpreting the same language, and it's a lot of very smart people who are trying to do the right thing in interpreting the standard, which caused me to think there's confusion on how to apply something, so we need to do something. What I've been struggling with is what? Clearly, finalizing the agenda decision would clarify and give people very, very timely guidance in the year of adoption. So there's a lot of benefit from my perspective in doing that. I know there are some other views in terms of an annual improvement, but to me that doesn't help from a timeliness perspective. And we know that this discussion exists, and if I'm I am a preparer, but as I'm thinking about applying, I'm certainly going to take this into consideration. I can't ignore it in determining how to look at something. In fact, we have a very similar fact pattern that we're going through in almost right now, and we used the one table in paragraph 3, which I think was extremely helpful in putting in pictures exactly kind of what the board intended in applying IFRS 16. So weighing pros and cons, even if I'm not 100% certain that this is the right way, I think there's certainly a lot of pros in finalizing the agenda decision as it's written, because it gives clear guidance right now for people applying the standard. I know I may be in the minority there, but I have sympathy for the other views, and it's that lack of clarity and the number of comment letters and the length of the comment letters that just gave me a lot of pause. So I don't know that there's a perfect answer here, but perhaps we need to consider what's the best answer given where we are in the year of adoption. And I think this is certainly not the first question we'll get from IFRS 16, particularly as regulators and others start to look in maybe a little more detail. And perhaps we add this, we start our kind of list of things to address in the PIR or when there is an annual improvement. I don't know if we could have an agenda decision and say, okay, when we do the annual improvement, perhaps it's something we can consider as well. I don't know if that's an option, but I'm certainly in favor of finalizing the agenda decision for this particular point.
Okay, thanks. Goro?
Thank you. I supported the staff's analysis and the recommendation in June, and from the user's point of view, I really like that the approach that of staff's analysis and the emphasizing basically substance over form, I think. And as many others are concerned that I share that it is concerned that I'm convinced by the staff's analysis, but there are lots of those who are not. And from these people's point of view, from the person like me who are convinced by the staff's view, that this agenda decision is clear enough. But there are so many people who are, very technical, smart people, technically smart people, objecting that this agenda decision. I found that in this paper, that your discussion is fine, but still you need to spend a lot of words to counter-argue all this disagreement, which suggests that I'm afraid that this agenda decision, it might be very difficult for us to rewrite or that agenda decision to convince people who are not satisfied with the original one. So that in order to make that our position more clear, I think that I have a sympathy with Bonnie also on user side, but the timeliness is important. But still, in order to make that our thought more complete, I would support annual improvement. Yeah, that's it.
Yang Su?
I want to say two things. The first one is that our decision seems to be simple, but the application is not that simple. After I looked at several negative comment letters, I talked with several practitioners in Korea, and they gave me many examples, variations of examples of the contract, and asked me what I thought about the enforceability of those contracts. And I was not able to answer clearly what is the enforceable period for most of the contracts they provided me. If I give you just one example that strikes me the most was this. The lessee has a contract with the lessor for 2 years.
Careful, because live fact patterns are not
I'm not trying to say, ask what's an answer of that, but I'm just trying to say the difficulty of applying this agenda decision to some specific, the contract form. So if you may, the lessee has a 2 years contract, but the contract does not have any, the option for extension. So every 2 years, lessor and lessee has to renegotiate the contract. But the lessee has an economic incentive to extend the contract. Then what is the enforceable period? Legally, lessee does not have any the authority or the right to extend it. But if we just look at the economic incentive, the enforceable period can be extended beyond the 2-year period. So I'm not saying I'm not trying to find out the answer to that specific situation. What I'm trying to say is that sometimes the application is not that easy. That's what I'm trying to say. That is why at the beginning I said we have to say something about the legal side of the enforceability in the agenda decision. Otherwise, there's going to be a lot of confusion in the practice. And one more thing I want to say is that in the staff paper, staff says some remarks on the BC 127 and says that BCs are not a part of the standard and BCs cannot override the standard. I 100% agree with that. But what I want to say is that if any BCs can confuse people, if any BCs can be read in a opposite or wrong direction from the standard, I think that BC can also be revised. So if we go for the standard setting for this agenda, then I suggest to look at BC 127 also.
Thank you. Brian?
A few general comments. I'm aware of the kind of heat around this issue and the interest in it. I think that some of the people who disagree with the analysis possibly think that the agenda decision is saying more than it's saying. As I suggested earlier, I do not think B34 is a grand statement about the role of economic incentives in standard setting. Generally, I think it is quite a specific statement about the test you apply to decide whether or not there is an option to which you apply the next test being the reasonably certain test. I think it's actually saying something quite narrow. I have heard outside this meeting the concern I've heard expressed in this meeting that maybe this kicks in whenever somebody's occupying a property or using somebody else's asset. I hear that concern a lot. To me, the discussion is specifically in the case of renewable and cancellable leases, arrangements in which there is an agreement that tells you what might happen in the future, and it's about working out what bits of that agreement I'm going to apply this specific test to. I have heard people say, well, how broad is penalty if it's broader than purely a cash payment? I'm not sure I know precisely how broad penalty is, but to me that is not a fatal flaw. That seems to me the kind of thing that gets sorted out in the rough and tumble of debates between preparers and auditors and audit committees, and I cannot honestly imagine the type of standard setting that would draw a definitive line above which you had a penalty, below which you didn't. So there are two questions in this paper. On the first question, do I support the analysis? I do. I appreciate and empathise a lot of the concerns, but I think the question is perhaps narrower than some of the concerns that I've heard expressed in this discussion.
Thank you, Brian.
Carsten. Yeah, just a comment on the point of timeliness. I was just wondering, I share the comment that Bonnie made. I share that concern that there's an issue about timeliness here. And so I was wondering whether narrow scope standard setting, just making a narrow scope amendment to IFRS 16 could be done on a more timelier basis. I mean, basically just changing the notion of penalty to make it clear that it's broader, which might, if that's a route that's worth exploring, it might resolve the concerns around timeliness.
If I may, what's the benefit of changing the standard when we would make it clear in the tentative agenda decision? Why would we take more time to change the standard when a tentative agenda decision in my view, results in the same effect.
To get acceptance by those who didn't apply the standard, which is honestly.
But there has to be acceptance of the agenda decision.
Which is already an achievement.
That's not the reason for an agenda decision.
Starting changed with what we did last time on IFRIC 23. So how would this be different? I don't understand the difference.
Well, I think the IFRIC 23 decision was based on a conclusion by the committee that there was an adequate basis to determine what to do. And I think that's a decision we need to make. Well, you need to make in terms of whether we issue an agenda decision or not.
Well, I guess
does it provide an adequate basis, and does it making sure as a safety check that it doesn't change the requirements?
And I guess my point is I don't view this any different regardless of the fact that I have a completely different view on the two different things.
So I think, Bonnie, you're saying that the basis of your position is that you think the requirements do provide an adequate basis, and therefore in thinking about the decision-making that says to you, you go to agenda decision.
You shouldn't be using standard setting versus agenda decision based on trying to make people accept things. Mary?
Reflecting on the discussion and looking again at the drafting of the first part of the Appendix A, the proposed wording of the agenda decision, the somewhat flippant opening remark is that I think the drafting starts out very much as this meeting does, with jumping in at the most difficult aspect, which is how do you consider from the standard as a whole the approach to things like penalties. But when I look at page 26, I want to go back to something Bertrand referenced in his opening remarks, the idea that it was valid, i.e. not an error, for somebody who had a contract that was drawn up as a 12-month contract to say, I have a 12-month contract, I stop there. I don't have to think of anything more in determining whether or not I have a longer lease term, just because it's written as 12 months, a very strict contractual. I think that is, to my mind, an error in the application of IFRS 16. Now, I'm not ruling on penalties, and when I look at page 26 of the agenda decision, of the paper, which has the draft final agenda decision, about halfway down, the committee observed item B. That is straight out of the authoritative text of the standard. It is nothing more than that. And so when I think about the committee's discussion of this issue, I think it is absolute, that you can't, I don't think we have to bring it up and say it, but when you have a 12-month lease, even if it has implicit rolling, you can't just say, I have a 12-month lease, nothing more needs to be, you have to apply B34. To ask the question of, what is the enforceable period? And then once you've done that, you then have to apply the sentence that comes below that. If you conclude that it's enforceable, then you apply these paragraphs to assess whether it's reasonably certain not to exercise, the option. Those two things are absolute and straight out of the standard. I think what I've heard from the committee's discussion this morning is when you are applying, and have heard previously, when you are applying B34, the question, the point where you might have a personal view, but you have some sympathy for others understanding it differently, is what do you consider when you're assessing whether there's more than an insignificant penalty? Mm. I don't think there should be any question of, do you just look at, well, it's written as a 12-month lease, I stop there. That to me is not reading a paragraph of the standard. But I think, I've heard many people say, I personally would have read it in the context of the standard to say that insignificant penalty would include consideration of economic factors. But I've heard people say that they read it differently. And I think that question of what you consider to be a penalty when you're determining whether or not you have an enforceable standard is the what the page 25 and a chunk of page 26 is kind of discussing up front. So I think if I were to say, what have I heard the committee say, I have not heard any basis for questioning point B and the sentence underneath it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that, that would just be suspending application of authoritative text of the standard. I think then you, you know, what you, you may or may not feel the need to acknowledge based on the discussion of the comment letters you receive of whether you think people had any reasonable basis for interpreting the word of insignificant penalty as being something other than the contractual cash penalty.
Thanks, Mary. What I'm trying to do in this round, just for people to consider whether their cards should be up or not, is I'd like to complete the technical discussion about the lease term, then move on to the technical discussion about useful life, and then come back to a conversation on standard setting or not.
Well, just to answer to Mary on one aspect, I don't agree with you that it's a correction of an error. It would have been if the standard had been crystal clear. And the standard, if the standard had been crystal clear, you wouldn't have issued a webcast or additional educational material to explain what was in the standard if the standard in itself was so clear. So I think that if people read it differently than you think it should have been, mm-hmm. and I think it should have been, it's maybe because the standard in itself, mm-hmm. without any additional material, is not that clear. And hence, I don't see how you can say that they will have to correct their accounting. For sure, whatever the mean we decide on, mm-hmm. they will have to correct, but it doesn't mean that because there's a correction, it's the correction of an error.
No,
it would have been the correction of an error if the standard in itself had been clear enough to...
But I think Mary was making a more basic point, which I agree with, which is if people didn't even think about penalties at all, they weren't applying B34... The webcast in this discussion, I think, is more about what sort of penalties do you think about and how do you think about that. But it should be, I hope, unquestionable that if you read the standard, you knew you needed to be thinking about penalties in order to apply B34. And I think that's the only point Mary's making. Then you can have a discussion about how broadly you need to think about penalties, but it's unquestionable you do because B34 says it in black and white. Guy?
I just want to pick up on one of the things Mary was saying, which I think is directly relevant to the point I was making. If I understood Mary's description correctly, she was describing a scenario where I have an agreement that only contemplates 12 months, and it doesn't contemplate a renewal right or a continuation with a termination option. It just contemplates 12 months, full stop. Her description sounded to me like I need to be assessing periods beyond anything that's even contemplated in an agreement. And if that's true, I'm not sure people are reading B34 in that context. And this was... This was the point I was trying to make in terms of we've introduced a definition of enforceability that then begs the question around, you know, what is it that I'm assessing? Am I assessing an agreement? Do I need an agreement to assess and apply that definition to? Or do I need nothing and I just apply that definition to assess what is enforceable?
So, Guy, I'll only respond to say without going beyond, because I think it is important. What Brian reminded us of is the question we were asked here is about cancelable and renewable leases, and that's the context for all of the discussion that we've had at the committee. Only if it's helpful, though, it's just to say a lease is a contract, and a contract is defined as an agreement, and it is defined as an agreement in the standard as well, so there is a link through to that.
Mary, I'm not sure I agree with you that if you did something else on enforceability, that is an error. As I said before, I think the logic there is tortured a bit. But I do agree that for B on page 26, mm-hmm. that there is enough there and that we are not standard setting
with respect to enforceability, and that part would be an agenda decision.
Yeah.
My focus has been on A.
I was just focusing in on B and somebody saying, oh, I didn't do that. The part that's described in B. That's where I was starting to get righteous.
And so I'm willing to be pointed to something, educated on A, because, well, I agree with the conclusion we came to in A. Feeling was, though, now I'm starting to, in A, because the guidance isn't that clear, am I pushing into the area now of standard setting by saying, hey, it's this broader economic incentive versus I've got enough in there. And I'm willing to be pointed to, you know, point me to, you know, where it is that I'm missing.
My comment was only with respect to B.
And I think most of the analysis actually on this topic is really on the point in A, because B we sort of think is a given.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Gary?
Really quickly, and maybe I'm getting to your last question, but sort of listening to agenda decision versus narrow scope versus interpretation is, as I think about it, I mean, most of the agenda decision questions that come in, they're in one of two buckets, one of which there is no standard and can make an analogy to something else, or is there diversity in reading and how to connect the dots in the paragraphs? That's what this is about. It really is that simple. And most of our agenda decisions say this is the way to read it, as opposed to the alternative ways, which is typically some say this, some say that in the question that comes in. It's, in that sense, it's operationally for us no different. We're saying this is the way we intended to read or believe it should be read or could be read. In there, when you step back again against the entire body of the standard, I mean, it's sort of hard to zero in on what one sentence says when everything else, definitely flows against it. It's even arguable if it is a discrepancy. But the whole tenor is you deal with some of these non-mandatory fixed minimum terms on the balance sheet. But but that's what we do in agenda decisions. It's how do you connect the dots? You know, the diversification of views of how to do so.
The question is whether you think there's enough dots or not.
we spent 4 years, you know, since this has been published on this vein. Yeah.
Okay, so you've been very disciplined. So now we're going to move on to a technical discussion on the second part of the paper, which is on the useful life question. So, the 72 only, is it? Yeah, well, from 69 onwards.
Yeah, that analysis there. Does anybody have any comments they want to make on that second typical part of the paper?
And then we'll move on to the question of what we do. We're all worn out. We can't wait to get on to the next bit. Carsten.
I mean, I can just say I think I completely agree with the stress analysis, and I think the wording is really balanced, right? I've heard quite a bit of discussion on whether the wording should be softer or stronger, but I think overall it's really balanced, so I support the analysis and also the conclusions.
Okay, thank you. Bertrand.
I think the staff analysis is quite pretty clear in this regards. I like the last sentence of paragraph 72 of the paper, which states the tentative agenda decision does not state that the useful life of leasehold improvements could never be longer than the related lease term, which I think is an important statement. Effectively, there might be circumstances, maybe rare in practice, but there might be circumstances and where it could be the case. So I think this sentence is quite an interesting one and useful, effectively.
Okay, so on to the question you all want to talk about. before we take a vote, do people want to make comments on the trickier question about what we do in terms of whether we finalise, and I think there might be a few variants actually, which would be, would we finalise the agenda decision as set out in Appendix A, or do we recommend that we do standard setting, which is 2B? I think a potential hybrid that maybe we might want to think about would be whether we would do an agenda decision which covers part B that Mary's been talking about, just to make the point that, of course, everybody needs to be thinking about enforceability in the context of B34 and maybe answering question two, and then thinking about whether, as a second step, we need to do something to deal with the question of what penalty to think about. So it wouldn't be going the whole way, but it would be at least making sure people are thinking about enforceability the way that 16 told you to think about enforceability.
And only if it's helpful to this discussion, because I know maybe timing around standard setting came up, just in context of for example, if the board were to do an annual improvement, there's no fixed timing in that. So if the board decided, based on your recommendation to do that, that can move more quickly. So I just wanted to clarify that if your assumption from reading what we wrote was if it's an annual improvement, it's going to take a long time, that is within the board's control. There's no fixed time frame, so that can move more quickly if need be.
What's quickly?
And I guess, I mean, the other thing is, before I hand over to you guys, just a reminder, the basis for an agenda decision is whether we think there's an adequate basis for reaching the conclusions. And a number of people have commented on the number of comment letters that we've got, and maybe at the risk of being provocative, I'll just kind of comment on that for a moment. If, as an organisation, we were to make decisions based on the number of comment letters we receive, we probably wouldn't have a leasing standard. If what you mean is you're paraphrasing for the fact that people have raised arguments which resonated with you in terms of making your assessment of whether there's an adequate basis, I completely agree with that. I think we just have to be careful not to encourage people who don't like answers to send us letters because they think we're going to count letters as a basis for our decision making. I'm sure none of you were doing that, but more for the base. People listening to the meeting. Carol?
So maybe a couple of points. I thought it was interesting just listening to the conversation going around the table with a lot of people saying that you, in analysing this, have agreed with the conclusion that the staff have reached, but you can understand why other people haven't. I think many of you would have benefited from the analysis that staff have done in two rounds of the process. But in many ways, I think that's what this committee does. It brings your greater knowledge, your greater ability to analyze, to then provide guidance to the people outside there to help point them in the right direction. And I think that is the benefit of an agenda decision. So I'd be nervous about simply saying, because other people out there who haven't had the benefit of the analysis we've looked at might have come to a different conclusion. I think that's what you're here for. That's exactly what the role is. And then I just wanted to pick up specifically on Carsten's point about the idea of a narrow scope amendment and whether we can accelerate a narrow scope amendment through the process. And I must be honest, and there's a little bit of a subtext, I think, in a lot of the letters we received that they didn't necessarily like the direction that the conclusion was taking them in, rather than didn't agree with the conclusion. And I suspect that would play very much into anything the board tried to do, whether it was narrow scope, annual improvement, or anything else. I think we would have to give a lot of time to people who would have preferred the standard to say something different, and therefore would be pushing us in that direction. So I don't think that there is a shortcut solution through standard setting for this. I think we would, if we went down that route, we would have to consider whatever people want to change in the standard, and that becomes a far riskier route, a far more difficult route to follow.
Bruce?
Strange. I was actually going to say almost the same thing. I mean, my concern with it was that when I asked how long you think it will take, I don't think there's a quick shortcut to this, because I think it's exactly the comment. People don't like the answer, and I really think that this is going to be a protracted argument. I'd be very surprised if you get an answer in the next year. And I guess the only comment I was going to have is when I spoke to people about this paper, no matter which side of the fence they sat on, they all seemed to indicate that they would like to get some guidance, given that they're not implementing the standard.
Thanks. And Bob?
So I'm going to ask a very naive question, going back to Interpretation Committee 101. So we have a third tool in our box. So we do agenda decisions when, hey, there is all the dots that are there. We're just helping you connect the dots as basis of there. An annual improvement when, hey, we think there needs to be something added to the standard. The third tool we've got is an interpretation. Mm-hmm. When do we use an interpretation, and is this possible for an interpretation?
Do you want to? I'll go first when you add. I think that's really important, by the way, in thinking about this, as Sue said. The decision-making here is, do you think the principles and requirements of the standard provide an adequate basis? If they do, I think the due process handbook would send you to finalising an agenda decision. If not, it sends us into narrow scope standard setting. And that, by the way, is the big difference. Agenda decision, because you think it provides an adequate basis, versus standard setting, because what's really important, more not for you, but for as well the outside world to know, is an interpretation is narrow scope standard setting. And so in terms of the process and what to do to our literature, it's exactly the same effect as doing an amendment, in the sense that it adds requirements. And which is why the due process connected to that also adds requirements. I think in this respect, just if it's helpful to clarify why, as staff, we were thinking in this context, if the committee thinks there's a need to do narrow scope standard setting, why we were more suggesting an annual improvement. First of all, because to us, this would be clarifying in nature, and therefore met the criteria for annual improvement. And it's almost potentially in thinking about the outcome and what would be most useful to stakeholders, is because we would think it's clarifying and quite minor, we could just put any change embedded within B34, and that prevents people from having to go and look at a completely separate document.
It's just neater.
Exactly. It's simply practical. An interpretation could be used in terms of process or anything else, but I think for us we were thinking it's just from a practical perspective.
And also, I guess, easier for people. If I'd answered the question, I would have said exactly what Petrina said, maybe with one extra addition. I think, and a number of people have said it during the discussion, I completely agree with it, we need to be conscious of when this discussion is happening and what's occurring. I think there's potentially a big difference between us going into B34 and maybe adding the word economic, if that's what the committee decides we need to do, is standard setting, which is a relatively focused, targeted change, versus writing an interpretation which might start to include more chat about what the concept of enforceability is in 16. Yep. Which could be a more fundamental change in logic for people who have just gone through the 16 process, yeah. Which is also, I think, why we the staff were thinking an annual improvement. But they're both standard setting. I'm not sure of order, but Gary, do you want to come in?
I'm actually going to step out of role to my former life here.
Okay. And
but we're 35 days from year end on a standard that's been out for almost 4 years, in which we had a consensus of a draft agenda decision 6 months ago. We need something going into year end, and just leaving it open won't deal with standard setting, which, as you say, is going to take time no matter how fast you do it. And if we're going into the definition of the lease or the measurement of the lease term, I mean, I really would worry, once you open that door a little bit, the door is open and other stuff comes through. So I think going to your end as a preparer, having this open-ended would be an absolute disaster, and having more than once in a career on that side is late-breaking news because of a different opinion. These things are just unsettling, not to mention difficult. There's can be... Again, I'm back to, I don't think there's any question what the board's intention has been since long before we even finalized the standard. And this is a problem not to, you know, give some clear guidance going right into year end. And I think even if we didn't give clear guidance, you know, then the written standard as it stands is what you got to close the books with. And so you're back to what are the clients, you know, what do the firms advising them to do, when it's very clear this discussion, all of our other work, says you take broader views and you take, you're dealing with measure judgments in the contract and the renewal periods. To conclude otherwise sort of flies in the face of the direction that the board has been giving all the way through here. And what do you do then, assuming we finalize this consistent with where we are in some other form of standard setting, is that a change in principle or is it correction of an error? I think those questions come down the line.
Yep.
So now I'll go back into my current role.
And I guess from my side, I'm thinking that if we did finalise an agenda decision, the comments we've been making on sufficient time would apply. Exactly. Very much to the...
Well, our comments were out there 6 months ago. you know, in a draft decision for something that wasn't viewed as an issue for 3 years. The other thing is, remember when we went through us and the FASB, the divergence language, this was not identified as an element of divergence, and they were very clear in the broader definitions.
Bonnie?
So I am a preparer, so I'll reiterate some of those comments of time, at this point, time being of the essence. And when I came into the meeting, I was leaning towards an annual improvement, and I think with the further discussion, I'm leaning now the other way towards an agenda decision, as I mentioned previously. I think we must, and I'll say to the regulators and the auditors in the room and are listening, we must respect the sufficient time on an agenda decision, which 35 days before year end may not be sufficient time. That being said, I do believe at this point in time an agenda decision is appropriate. The words are in there. I respect that there have been different interpretations, but I think the words and the concepts are in I-416.
Bertrand.
I'm not worried by the time issue that some I've raised so far. Two comments on that. Or one comment on that. I mean, as a European preparer, I have transitioned to IFRS back in 2004, 2005. We have lived 20 years without IFRS 16. I think we can live an extra couple of years with a not 100 perfectly applied IFRS 16. So timing is really not of that urgency, I think. First thing, and
yes,
second.
Did you say that was okay for?
Sorry.
How many years did you say it was okay for?
No.
You didn't say 20, did you?
You said quickly. I said a couple of years. if I correctly understand English, it means 2 years. Not much than that. So, but it will be your call. I mean, if it were a standard setting, it would be your call as a board member. And that's the first comment. And the second one to draw the distinction between or to illustrate the distinction between standard setting and agenda decision, I would say agenda decision, to echo what Bonnie said on IFRIC 23, I mean, of course it's an agenda decision if we reach a decision. I do not agree with the conclusion we reach here, but I mean it's the conclusion we reach, so it is imposed to me, and I need to comply, so we will. But it's just a reclassification problem, so it's very easy to do. I mean, no problem. Carl mentioned another subject on IFRS 15. I mean, the reading in the standards was transfer of control is transfer of risk and rewards plus something else. People stopped at transfer of risk and rewards. Of course, they did not apply correctly the standard, and so it's an agenda decision. There, on this issue, what the discussion showed, what the number of letters showed, is that there are auditors, enforcers, maybe not enforcers, but auditors, preparers from all jurisdictions that think the standard could be enhanced, improved, by just adding some more clarification, so that it ends up being almost 100% clear. So far, fine. I mean, I can hear that, even though I didn't read the standard that the way some did. I mean, I can perfectly understand that. And it's not just the number of comment letters received, it's the variety of those commenting, actually, which struck me the most. The thing is also on IFRS 16, when you have to transition to IFRS 16, I mean, I was rather lucky to have just hundreds of contracts, hundreds of lease contracts. But people, some companies had thousands of lease contracts in hundreds of jurisdictions. The IT applications are still 100% efficient. You have some IT providers that were not able to provide on a timely basis IFRS 16 IT tools, and which still are not capable of doing it. You still have mechanical errors coming out from the mere application of those of some systems. So it cannot be done like a reclassification. It's impossible. So it will obviously, for those that read the standard differently, it will take time for them to address the issue, and probably it will be the same time as it will take the ISB to do some form of clarification to the words. So I'm not worried by this timing issue for in many circumstances and many ways actually.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
I think timing is a problem or is a concern for us right now. First of all, there's nothing wrong with the 16th and the wording, and the fundamentals are correct and agree with the staff analysis and all the reasonable reading and the explanation we could get here and give to the preparers. But we do have an annual report due in 3 months of time. Yeah, we have the annual close, and then we have about 2-3 months to prepare for the book. So we should have a clear line to draw here so that the whole world should know what they should do. And then we, through the agenda decision, we give them a better or further explanation and guide them through. That's it. And I don't think we should waste too much time on changing these explanations. And that's where I stand.
Chung-Wu?
Thank you. I think this is a very difficult issue because many our stakeholders gave us a kind of different views. But however, as Bonnie said, there are now regardless of what the timing issues for preparers are. However, there is no big change we expect from the some kind of annual improvement or some kind of interpretation. So I think Bonnie's idea is very nice, just to finish. Finalize this agenda decision, but if you need some more clarification, there's also Steve suggesting some kind of additional exploratory materials in addition to this agenda decision. So rather than going to the direction of interpretation, we already provided some kind of educational material on this list. So if that is not enough, then we can provide more on your concerns. So maybe there will be another direction to finalize this agenda decision now.
Thank you. Marie?
It's a topic we discussed, and we do have split view among regulators on what would be done. Some considering that an agenda decision is enough and would better address the notion of timing, and some other, and I'm part of this camp, considering that standard setting would be more useful and is better as long as it's done on a timely basis. But if it's a annual improvement, I understand it can be done quite quickly and can be within hour. And why we consider for some that standard setting will be better is that it might have huge impact from some issuer and it's already too late, I think, to apply it by year-end. So as you said, this notion of sufficient time may apply, but after you have a lot of question of what exactly it means and when this sufficient time will sort of stop, which might be difficult. There will be also some question of transition, how people deal with this transition, what they said. And it having a standard setting will also help just to address and clarify adding few words in the standard or around this notion of penalty. I fully agree that it should be something really, really specific and really, really narrow and not open again the whole discussion. But I think it can be done on easily by year-end, next year-end, so it will be better.
Easily, yes.
Very optimistic.
Young Sue?
I just want to echo, we can finish up this agenda decision by finalizing it as it is. We can ask the board to start considering the standard setting for B34. So if we go two tracks, then we can help the practitioners as well as we can thoroughly investigate what is the problem with B34.
When I take a vote, I think I'll take a vote on a clean decision. But yes, Bob.
I just want to address the comments by Gary and Chung Wu. So I do appreciate the practicalities and the position that we're putting practitioners and preparers in. But maybe I'm looking at this wrong, but the way I'm looking at it is it's not, well, I think about that, but I can't use that in my decision. My decision is all about due process.
Adequate basis, yes.
Yeah.
Right? It's about, okay, I just want to make sure I'm thinking about this right. I have to think about whether, and it's a hard, very hard decision, but whether it's about due process and whether it's adequate basis for an agenda decision or...
No, we agree with that, Bob. I'm just saying there's a knock-on consequence of certain decisions or lack thereof. That's all. Just be aware of the total mix of factors.
All right. So with that, it's crunch time. So, and that was a good reminder, Bob. So based on what you've read in the paper, what you've read in the comment letters, the input that you've given one another this morning... responses you've got. Now you need to search your souls. Answer a very simple question. Whether you think you should finalise an agenda decision because your conclusion in your personal capacity is that you believe that there is an adequate basis for an entity to determine the lease term of cancellable and renewable leases, and also that there's an adequate basis to determine the useful life. That's all you have to think about. Is there an adequate basis or not? So with that, if you agree with that, you should be, I think, agreeing to issue an agenda decision. I'm not going to look, so I'm not going to put any pressure on you. I'll let somebody else count. Hands for who believes that there is an adequate basis and that, therefore, they support finalising the agenda decision set out in Appendix A. Majority.
That's a majority.
Let's vote the alternative one because some might vote twice. It has already happened.
Okay. Oh,
wow.
I think it's coffee time. We take a break now. This will be an. In the board's view that they're entitled to sufficient time if they need to change their accounting policy as a result of this agenda decision, because I think this could be a very real case where people need sufficient time.
Mm-hmm.
We always say it at the start of the update, but completeness for those listening. All right, so with that, let's take a break until...